Hi, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Maureen. Thanks, Sandy. The last thing I expected was to be standing up here tonight. There are a lot of friends of mine in this room tonight, a lot of people who have heard me speak before, probably tired of my story and my jokes, but I ask you to bear with me. It's actually kind of a special night tonight. I'm happy to be here to celebrate sobriety with friends and to actually give back to the program and to people who may be new in the room tonight. And I'm up here to tell you my story, a little bit about what it was like for me, what happened that got me here, and what it's been like since I got sober. It's only my story. I don't speak for AA. If you don't relate to me, if you don't like anything I have to say, there's another meeting somewhere else tomorrow night. And I'll start at the beginning. I'm 51 years old. As of the 2nd of September this year, I have celebrated 21 years of continuous sobriety in this program. And I kind of think that if I can get sober and stay sober, anybody can. Because I didn't really think I was an alcoholic when I walked in this room. And it was this room. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the 2nd of September 1986 was in this room. It was a Tuesday night, it was Tuesday Beginners, and we were facing that way. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm a middle child of a middle-class family. I have an older sister and a younger brother. I had two parents growing up, and there was no alcoholism in my family. I didn't know an alcoholic. I had no alcoholic relatives that I knew of, and I knew what an alcoholic stereotype was, you know, that it was the guy on the park bench with the brown paper bag. I also knew that it could be a man in a three-piece suit who lived in West Mountain, drank martinis, and beat his wife. And whatever my stereotypes were of an alcoholic, it wasn't me. I'm a little bit nervous tonight because I wasn't prepared to get up here. I would much rather be sitting down there judging the speaker. So, but there's one thing that I know, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I'm grateful to be sober, that I wouldn't trade being sober for anything, and that coming to meetings and listening to speakers and talking to people helps me stay grateful and helps me understand and remember why I don't drink today. So, like I said, I didn't know any alcoholics growing up, and I didn't really think I had a problem with drinking. Drinking didn't have an impact on my life until I was in my late teens. And I only know that, and I only know how drinking impacted my life from listening to people at meetings and being able to relate. And I had a pretty normal childhood, but I had those feelings that I hear a lot of speakers talk about, that I wasn't good enough, that no matter how good I did or how what I did, it wasn't enough. I got that message in my house growing up that I was okay, but if I only ate a little less, I would be a little slimmer. If I only dressed a little nicer, I would be a little bit more presentable. If I only, you know, studied a little harder, I would get 100% instead of the 85% that I used to bring home. And, you know, it was my mother's way of trying to motivate me to achieve, but what it did is made me feel that I wasn't good enough. And my older sister went through school with her entire school career, including her master's, with straight A's, never got less than an A in her life. And my younger brother got a scholarship into med school from CEGEP, which was renewable every semester if he stayed in the top 10% of his class, which he did. And in between, there was me. And my motto was that I didn't let school interfere with my life. So I was a rebel without a cause. And I was that classic middle child syndrome. I had a humongous inferiority complex and a galloping superiority attitude, and I was a minimal input for maximum output person. The least I could do to get away with it, the better I liked it, And I managed to scrape by doing as little as I could and getting the most that I could out of life until alcohol started to take that away. And some of the clues that I had along the way was I had a boyfriend when I was 15. He was really good looking. He had a cleft in his chin. He was really handsome, and he was my boyfriend from the time I was 15 till I was 18. And that was really good for me to get me through high school because of my inferiority complex. You know, in grade school I had two friends. Their names were Heather and Donna, and they were tall and slim and popular with the boys. And I wasn't tall and I wasn't slim, but I was popular with the boys because I was a tomboy. And I would play sports and I would play with the boys. Girls were very boring. I didn't like them at all. And so that's how I got along with the boys. But when I had this boyfriend, I felt that I was as good as all the other girls. You know, I had somebody to take me to Sweet 16, and I had an external reason to feel that I was okay. You know, I had to have something on the outside to look good, because inside I didn't feel good, even at that age. And at 18 years old, I told them to get lost, because I wanted to smoke cigarettes and I wanted to drink and I wanted to do all sorts of stuff. And he wouldn't let me because he was very possessive, and he said he loved me, and I didn't respect him for it, you know. And so I told him to take a hike, and I wasn't very happy, you know, as soon as I told him to leave, because I was sorry, because, you know, I found myself alone. And everybody who knows me and loves me and is tired of listening to me knows that I don't do alone well. And I remember telling my dad that the next time I met somebody, I would be in the old people's home in a rocking chair, and maybe the person in the rocking chair beside me, you know, I might connect with. But as the time went on, I did meet somebody. Met somebody in a bar after skiing. He was a ski patroller, and I started to ski with this guy. And we started to date, and we would go out, and we'd get home really early. I'd be home, like, in my house before 11 o'clock at night. And I would say, you know, when I was younger, I used to stay out later, like, what's going on? And he said, well, as soon as the ski season is over, you know, we'll stay out a little later. And as soon as the ski season was over, I remember being out in the bars on Crescent and Bishop and getting home one morning at 4 in the morning and crawling into my house. And I was, like, really, really, I was smashed. And my mother was standing at my bedroom door with her arms crossed, you know. And I ended up marrying this guy when I was 20. And I had a good life with him. I had no children. I had no responsibilities. I was in university. I was studying. And I thought when I came to AA that I was a social drinker. And I was, because I drank at every social occasion I could. And I always had somebody who was going to drive me home. So I never had to worry about where I was going to end up, and I never had to worry about drinking and driving. And I was married for about 7 years, and I skied in the Alps, and I went south, and I played golf, and I graduated from university, and I started working. And one day, this man walked into our home and told me that it was over, that he didn't love me anymore, and that I was lewd, crude, and obnoxious when I drank. And I just thought he couldn't take a joke, because I thought I was very funny when I drank. I went on a ski trip one year, and I won Joke of the Chip Award, but I didn't know they were talking about me. But I thought it was the jokes that I told. But anyways, life from that moment on changed for me. I was 27 years old. I didn't know anything about looking after myself. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I didn't know anything about anything. And I started to drink on a daily basis from that point on. And I went through a rough time. You know, I had to sell the house that I lived in, and I would make friends and lose them, and I would go out and I would drink, and I would get drunk, and I would stay in people's houses, like, because, you know, I didn't drink and drive at that point. And I was miserable and bitter and angry. And one day I was face down on somebody's beige shag rug crying, and I wore makeup back then and was wearing mascara, and it was all dripping down my face, and I was crying because I was a poor me kind of drunk, poor me, poor me, pour me another drink. And this little voice in the back of my head said, I don't think they want you here anymore. And so I drove myself home, and I started my drinking and driving career, which wasn't very nice, and I'm very, very grateful that I didn't have any accidents and I didn't hit anybody or kill anybody, or I probably would have been okay if I did damage to myself, but I don't know how I would have survived if I did damage to somebody else. And I would drive home from bars at after closing, before in the morning, I'd fall asleep at red lights, and I'd stumble into my apartment and I'd pass out and I'd sleep for a couple hours and I'd get up and go to work the next day. And at noon, I'd drag myself down the hall to my apartment saying, oh my God, what have I done? I'm not going to do this again, and I'd have a cup of tea for lunch. And it was amazing how much better I felt at 4:30. And at 4:30, I felt better, and I just did it all over again. I met somebody in a bar, and we got together, and I had somebody to drink with. And, you know, life was good again. I was with somebody. I had no idea I was an alcoholic. And one night, this person and I had a fight. We had a bottle of scotch in the house and had this moment of clarity that maybe the drinking had something to do with the argument. And I poured the bottle down the toilet, you know, a horrible thing to do. And and I went to speak to, actually this person walked out on me and told me to grow up, which was a button of mine because I didn't have a reputation for being very mature to start with. And it was one of the things that bugged me, you know. And I went to speak to a cousin of mine, and I told my cousin about this episode, and my cousin said, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I said, no, it's not me. I'm not the one with the problem. And my cousin said, you know, I've been to AA. I went with a friend of mine. It was really interesting. Maybe you should think about checking it out. And I said, sure. I followed it in the back of my head because, after all, I'm not an alcoholic, and I didn't have a problem with alcohol. And I went that weekend, with Labor Day weekend, 1986, and I went to the club that I golfed at, and by that time, I wasn't making it through 9 holes of golf even. You know, I'd get off the course before 9 holes of golf because my golf sucked, and I would go in and I would start drinking. And my mother and father were members of this course, and my mother used to tell the bartender not to serve me alcohol. You know, I was paying my own bills, so there wasn't really much that she could do about it. But I used to like to drink martinis, and the bartender would put my martinis in a water glass so that my mother wouldn't know that I was drinking. And, you know, that kind of pissed me off because I didn't get to have the olives with it, you know. Like, most people don't drink water with olives. But, you know, my family, they were on my back. They really, you know, they just didn't know how to let up, you know. My mother, you know, I would go there for dinner and I'd have a scotch before dinner, and then I'd have a second one and she'd say, what do you need that for? We're going to eat. And I'd say, like, what does one have to do with the other? Like, I couldn't figure out. I never did give up eating for drinking, but I couldn't figure out why she was bugging me. And my brother, who was in med school, used to give me a lecture. The one lecture I think they get in med school about alcoholism, about how many ounces of alcohol I needed to drink from a woman my age and my size before getting cirrhosis of the liver. And I was just like, you know, like, fuck off, you know, like, leave me alone, what is your problem? And anyway, so here I am now, you know, I have one marriage that didn't last, and a relationship that split up because of alcohol. And I'm speaking to this cousin, and she's telling me about AA. So that weekend at the club, I was signing chips because you don't have to hand over cash when you're a member of a private club. You just have to sign your name and then pay the bill at the end of the month. And I was buying drinks for everybody so that I could keep drinking. And Tuesday, September 2nd, 1986, I'm at work, and I get a phone call from my ex who had walked out on me. Asking me if I still wanted to do what we talked about. And I said, what's that? Because, you know, I used to get drunk and call. It's called dialing for pain. And I was very good at it. And this ex of mine, we used to go to bars, and there would be people in the bars who were either on slips or they were sober members who were in bars. It's one way to carry a message. It's not my way. And my friend would point out people and say, you see that person over there? They're an alcoholic, but they don't drink, you know, or something like that. And so we had talked about going to AA. And the phone call I got, I said, you know, you still want to go? And I said, go where? And my friend said, you know, the Automobile Association. Yeah. And I said, well, you know, you arrange it. You're the one who knows all the alcoholics. You arrange it. So that night we were supposed to meet people on the corner of Green and de Maisonneuve at 8 o'clock because we were going to an 8:30 meeting, which turned out to be Tuesday Beginners, and we had to know the rules before we got here because this was a secret society and we had to know, you know, what to do and what not to do. So I had therapy that night because, you know, that's what you do when relationships break up. You go into therapy. And then, you know, when you find someone else, you stop therapy, you know. But I was in therapy that night, and I hadn't gone home for lunch that day. I used to drink at lunchtime. Somehow my afternoons of work were a lot more pleasant than my mornings. And I hadn't gone home for lunch that day, so I hadn't had a drink yet. And at 8:25, I went from my therapist to the corner here. At 8:25, because I was supposed to be there at 8, at 8:25 this big green jalopy pulled up, screeched up to the curb, two women jumped out, shook my hand, patted me on the back, bundled me into the car, and took me here. So, picture this, 21 years ago, Tuesday night, room, packed, little tables, little candles on the table, people smoking, the air, you could cut it, it was so thick with smoke, and I don't think I smoked at the time, and I certainly didn't drink coffee. Because I had slogans to live by out there, you know. Water, don't drink water, it rusts the pipes. Cognac is the nectar of the gods. You know, I mean, I had important slogans to live by. And I come down those stairs, and I walk in, I sit down, they give me a cup of coffee, and speaker, you know, they do this, the speaker gets up, and I think I remember who it was, but I'm not sure. And all I know is I'm 29 years old, and I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm listening to the speaker. I'm drinking coffee in a smoke-filled room that looks like a bar to me because, you know, the lights were out and the candles were on the table. And I said to myself, I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess that means I don't go home and take a drink tonight. And after the meeting, we went out for coffee. We had more coffee. And I said to the people at the table, I said, I'm not going to sleep tonight. I've never drank so much coffee in my life. And they wrote their phone numbers on a piece of paper and they handed it to me and they said, you call us any time of the night or day. If you want to pick up a drink, you call us instead. This one woman said to me, she said, I share an apartment with other alcoholics, and we'd understand. I thought these people were absolutely out of their minds. I mean, who wants a stranger calling them at 4 in the morning? Anyways, I went home, and I guess I slept that night. I went to work the next day, and I must have given them my phone number because I got a phone call at work the next day. And I was taken to my next meeting, which turned out to be my home group for the next 12 years of my sobriety. It was called Live and Let Live. They had two meetings a week. And I never forget, you know, that first meeting there, I now hadn't had a drink for 2 days. It was Thursday night. It was a 12th and 12th, with a 12-step study. They were reading from the 12 and 12, that blue and white striped book. And it was there were 10 people in the room sitting around a table, and they were going around the table and they were saying, hi, my name is so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic, and my heart's like pounding. My heart is pounding. It's like, I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And what was I going to say when they got to me? And they, you know, passed the book and they were reading it, and they got to me, and, you know, I always wanted to fit in. I always wanted to be like everybody else. You know, I always... Even though I was a rebel without a cause, I still, you know. So I said, hi, my name is Maureen, and maybe I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And it was the discussion because they stopped reading one person before they got to me. And it was the eighth step. And I said, I don't know anything about the eighth step because I'm only 2.5 days sober because I see that one day at a time right from my first meeting. You know, that one day at a time, I could understand that. I could relate to that. When I was out there and miserable and spiritually bankrupt and not wanting to live anymore, I found a card in a store that said, I've got a new philosophy. I'm just going to dread one day at a time. And I bought that card and I put it on my bureau in my bedroom. So I understood one day at a time. And I used that one day at a time. And everybody clapped. Wow, you know, 2.5 days sober, hooray! You know, and then somebody took a cake that night. I don't know who it was. I think it might have been a year cake. And they gave me the first piece because I was 2.5 days sober. Man, the tension, food, what more could anybody want? I mean, seriously. So, you know, I started my journey in sobriety. And, you know, I'm not going to go through it all. It's 21 years of not picking up a drink one day at a time. But it was very interesting, you know, journey for me because I was belligerent. I was arrogant. I'm bad now, but I was worse then. And I, you know, people used to love to laugh at me at discussion meetings because I could prove anything the big book had to say wrong, and I didn't have a power greater than myself that was anything spiritual, because the second step in the 12 and 12 said that I could use the group. That if there were 10 people who were sober and I was one, 10 was greater than one. I couldn't argue with that. Because I was one of those people they talk about in the big book that was too intelligent for my own good. And I couldn't argue that 10 was greater than 1. And my 9-year-old daughter knows that greater than sign. You know, 10 is greater than 1. And I used that. I used my sponsor. And I remember being 3 weeks without a drink in this program and feeling sorry for myself and lying in my bed and looking at the clock and crying. I don't want to be an alcoholic. I don't want to spend my life in church basements. I don't want to be friends with alcoholics. I just want to be normal. Why doesn't someone call me? And I'm watching the time, and it's getting later and later. Why doesn't someone call me? I don't want to be an alcoholic. And at 11:30, I said, fuck it, and I pick up the phone, and I called, you know, that woman who took me to my first meeting and who was my sponsor, and I said, I don't want to be an alcoholic. I just want to be normal. And she told me, she said, you know, you're not a bad person. You're just a sick person trying to get well. And if you can go to bed at the end of the day and put your head on the pillow and didn't pick up a drink that day, you've had a good day. And so I did, you know, one day at a time. I picked up the phone and I called somebody instead of picking up a drink. I guess I had had enough, you know. And today I know it was grace and the support of the people in the program, because it certainly wasn't me. You know, I didn't think I was powerless over alcohol. When I was 3 months sober, I was with some friends, and we had a discussion. Would you pick up a drink for $1 million? And I said, sure. Because it was me. It was my willpower that wasn't drinking, you know. I'd take a drink and put $1 million in the bank, go to AA the next day. And so we had a nice little discussion on that one drink and what it would look like and what it would turn into. And after one drink, well, who cares, you know. And that one drink would probably be in a double, and then after that, who cares, tomorrow's another day, et cetera, et cetera. But I had to live life on life's terms one day at a time, and I was 15 months in this program without a drink before I came to understand what being powerless over alcohol meant for me in my life. And little coincidences along the way and talking to people, and I remember being in a meeting, and I was talking about this earlier today, listening to a speaker say, you know, when normal people have a problem, their first instinct is, how do I solve this problem? When alcoholics have a problem, their first instinct is, gee, the drink would be good now. And I remember being at home, and something came up, as it always does, and I said, Jesus, the scotch would be good now. And I went, uh-oh. You know, little ding-dong, little lights, little bells that rang along the way. And I did my steps, you know, kicking and screaming and not wanting to, and I did them anyway. And I think one of the things that I've always had in this program was a willingness to stay sober, a willingness to do what I have to do, a willingness to stay plugged into the program, a willingness to pick up the phone and call. And no matter what, I knew instinctively from the beginning that no matter what happens, they used to stay in AA 20 years ago, and I'm sure way before then, I'm sure they still say it, if your ass falls off, you pick it up and get to a meeting. And my home group was my lifeline. And it's a good thing I didn't know anything about anything there, because that was my lifeline. And I ran there, and I talked, and I used the people, and I used the program, and I worked the steps. And I built myself a good foundation in sobriety. You know, life happens over 21 years, you know. Relationships come and go, people die, you know. I was with somebody in the program for 7 years, and we owned a house together, and we split up, and I had to sell the house, and it was one of the hardest things that I had to do. And I had to go, and I had to look for an apartment. And the day we signed the sale, I was out looking at apartments on my own, by myself, you know. And it was hell. And I remember being curled up in a fetal position in bed saying, God, you better help me, because I'm going to end up in the Douglas, because I can't do this. And the next day, a cousin of mine who managed the apartment building said, you know, I have an apartment available. And I went to see it with my aunt, and it was on the top floor. And I looked out on a beautiful view, and I felt like I was on the top of the world, and I had some hope, and I rented this apartment, and I told my sponsor, I have a new apartment. And she said, well, what's the apartment number on my apartment? And I said, oh, it's easy to remember. It's 1212. And she said, oh, Maureen, you're moving into the 12 and 12. So, you know, my life is very, very much enmeshed in this program. Without this program, I wouldn't be sober. Without this program, I'd be a lot more insane than I am. You know, the second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Doesn't say would. And I'm still working on it. And I try to be humble. And I try to keep things in perspective. And I don't always succeed. And I make a lot of mistakes. And I'm very human. And when I was about 8 years sober, I fell off my own pedestal. And I try. And I don't always do the best that I can do, I know. But I do know that no matter what, I know a drink will not make anything better. And somebody recently asked me if it was difficult for me to stay sober. And I said, there's nothing that I haven't done in sobriety that I've enjoyed and that has been good, nothing I haven't done drinking, you know, that I haven't done in sobriety without a drink. And that I do not need that drink to enjoy life or to live my life. And I don't take it for granted, you know. I don't take my sobriety for granted. I think it's important for me to be able to stand up here and say that I'm sober and that I'm grateful to be sober and that it's possible and that if I did it, anybody can do it. All it takes is a willingness, or they say the how, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And and I had that, and I still have that. And if you're here and it's your first meeting or you're struggling, it is possible. It is possible to not pick up that first drink just for today. And I still go on that principle myself. Not that I struggle with drinking every day, but I know that if I stayed away from this program and I didn't do the things that I needed to do to stay sober, that I could pick up a drink just like anybody else. And I've seen people do it over the years. And I don't want it to be me. So I'd like to thank Sandy for asking me to share. Actually, I wouldn't like to thank him. I'd like to kill him for asking me to share. However, it's always good for me to know and to remind myself where I came from and why I'm grateful to be sober. And I'd like to wish all of you a happy, healthy, joyous, and free sober 24 hours. Thank you.